So I'm going to talk about recent work with Wheatcraft T-shirt lensing and how we might SGR with it. So first I'm going to review, of course, Wheatcraft T-shirt lensing. I'm going to talk about why we do it, but also how we do it in principle. I know this is an Institute of Theoretical Physics, so I'm going to discuss a bit of the observations, so you know how it is that we can learn about the universe through Wheatcraft T-shirt lensing. And I'm also going to discuss my recent work with expanding the parameterized post-Friedmani framework, which is a way for us to get model-independent constraints on modified gravity through any probe, but I'm going to discuss specifically Wheatcraft lensing. And then I'm going to finish by talking about that high-altitude lensing observatory, which is a new concept that we're developing at JPL for a balloon-borne Wheatcraft lensing survey. And again, this is a theoretical physics institute, but I think it's a very exciting idea and something that I've been working on a lot lately. So here's Wheatcraft lensing. So as I'm sure you're all familiar, matter acts like a lens. So if we have us here with our telescope and we have some distant source, in vacuum, the light rays will move according to what we perceive as being straight lines. But then if we have a cloud of, say, dark matter or something in the way, then the light ray paths will be bent and the object will look distorted. So if we say that the unperturbed path gives us a position on the sky theta, and then because of the perturbation, that changes to theta prime, there is this deflection angle we usually call alpha. And we can write the perturbed positions in the sky as a function of the unperturbed ones with this AIJ tensor telling us the transformation. And if we know the gravitational potential of whatever dark matter or whatever kind of matter is along the line of sight, there's a 2D projected gravitational potential psi that tells you what this AIJ tensor should be. So why should we care? Well, this is a direct relationship between where matter is in the universe and distortions of images that we see, of objects that lie behind that matter. And most of the matter in the universe, we think, we can't see just by looking at it. So this is a way in which we could robustly map out the entire matter distribution of the universe, including in dark matter. And if anybody has any questions along the way, feel free to interrupt.
Yeah. So what is this, you know, IJ? You have two angles in this kind of psi, I mean,
so there's theta, they're the angular positions in the plane of the sky. So there's it's a 2D vector.
And in general it's not a rectangle. I mean,
in general,
so the two angles are normally different. One is theta and then is one is phi.
That's a fine expression. Theta I is theta one is theta, theta two is phi.
Right.
Yeah. Theta is just the vector angle in the sky, 2D angle.
Because it's spherical coordinate, so usually the two angles are not on the same.
Oh, but it is, we usually use what's called the flat sky approximation, where it is rectangular coordinate system on the sky. So we're taking the limit that you're looking at a very small patch, where you can assume it's flat. Okay. So we have some total matter distribution in the universe, and because of the gravitational potential that comes from the matter distribution, there's this field of these distortions, and there are different kinds of distortions. So images that get distorted through gravitational lensing, they can be magnified, or rotated, or sheared, or stretched. And so those different kinds of distortions, they affect the galaxies that we see, and so we have these measurable changes to galaxy shapes. And that's what we actually observe. And so the goal with Wheatcraft lensing observations is to unravel this process and look at the measurable galaxy shape changes and then work our way backwards to deduce what the total matter distribution is. So how we do this in practice is we look at a field of galaxies on the sky and we look in patches of it, small patches, but large enough so that it contains a significant number of galaxies. And then we look at the ellipticities of the galaxies, and we look for a preferred direction. So we average over the galaxies in Patch of Sky, there will be some preferred direction, and that preferred direction is a good estimator of this shear, I'm calling gamma, where if you have the lens potential along the line of sight again, and I write out this AIJ tensor again, you can decompose it like so. So it's the identity matrix, and there's a convergence kappa, and then the shear gamma. And you see from the form of that matrix that kappa tells you how much magnification happens, and gamma is a measurement of how much stretching there is in the image. And so, so stretching, it turns out that's the easiest to get out of an image. It's hard to know for a given galaxy how bright it is intrinsically. It's hard to know what orientation it had, but we can see what their shapes are and look statistically define the shear by looking for preferred directions. And we also typically separate the ellipticity or the shear out into two components. There's E1, which is the component that's parallel to the pixels, and then E2, which is diagonal to the pixel direction. So that's how we get the shear out of an image. And you can see that you would like to have a lot of galaxies in the sky. You'd like to have a large number density of galaxies so you have good statistics. But then there are other reasons why this is hard. Because there are many other effects that also distort galaxy images. So you can't just look at the field of galaxies in the sky and assume that all the distortions that you see are due to weak lensing. There are other effects that are actually much larger than the weak lensing effects. Weak lensing is only about 1% effect. So the biggest problem is atmospheric seeing if you make these measurements from the ground. And this is why I'm going to talk about our idea to do a balloon-based survey later so that we can sidestep this effect. But what happens from the ground is atmospheric turbulence blurs your images. So if you have from the top panel what you'd see from space, on the left is Aegis T galaxy, on the right is what it would look like sheared a very large amount. And then the bottom is what the same galaxy would look like from the ground with atmospheric seeing worked in. You see that it looks a lot rounder than it really should be. And so atmospheric seeing makes things look rounder, and it swamps the weak lensing signal and reduces it artificially. So that's something that needs to be corrected for. There are also astrophysical reasons why galaxies would be lined up with each other. And so it's not always a weak lensing effect. Galaxies that are forming the same tidal field will start to be aligned, and there are a whole host of effects of an astrophysical nature. There's also a blurring effect on the images just from the instrument itself and from the detectors, and then even your data analysis. So I've been working on this series of two papers here where we looked at what happens if you compress the data in a lossy fashion, which actually will probably be necessary for next generation surveys like Euclid or JDOM, which are going to have, which are going to produce more data that we can actually transmit back to Earth.
Actually, do you know the number for that? How much data? What's the ratio?
So we want a factor of 3, you think? But this is all very sketchy. JDOM and Euclid are actually in very early design stages. So, but we think we need about factor of 3. And we've shown in these papers, actually, that we think that is achievable with a negligible order 10 to the minus 4 potential bias in the sequencing signal, which is actually below the statistical errors. So a useful tool for determining, both characterizing all these different effects and then determining how to mitigate them, are survey simulations that we've been developing at Caltech and working on. So we have a weak lensing image simulation pipeline. We have a paper on that that I thought was going to be out by today, but it's apparently not. So these are my first experiences not being first author on a paper, and so it's kind of weird that I'm not in control of my affairs in the archive. But it should appear soon. And so this is a tool we use to simulate what you would see from hypothetical future surveys like JDEM or Euclid. And we can put in all these systematic effects that I was just talking about to, first off, figure out the size of the effects, and then also determine ways to mitigate the effects and test our data analysis pipelines. So what we do is we take galaxies from the Hubble ultra deep field, and then we decompose them into shapeless space. So shapeless, it's an orthogonal set of basis functions where you can take any galaxy image and decompose it into a linear superposition of these basis images. And here's an example of what happens if you go out. You see there's n and m numbers. And if you go out to n of 20, you can reproduce galaxies extremely well. So here's the original image, and then here's the shape layer reconstruction. So what we do is we take these galaxy images from the Hubble ultra deep field, we put them in a shapeless space, and so then we have these probability distribution functions for what, in shapeless space, galaxies tend to look like in the universe. And then we can resample randomly from that probability distribution function to make new random galaxies and then put them in our new images. And we do that with all these user inputs in mind. So there's a throughput ratio with respect to UDF that the user puts in, the pixel scale, the noise properties, the PSF, and all that stuff is specified by the user. And you can also put in a weak lensing shear. And so this simulation was used by the shear testing program collaboration because it turns out I don't know if I made it sound easy or hard, but it's actually very, very difficult to extract the weak lensing information from images. And so this simulation pipeline has been a very valuable tool in testing ways to remove that signal and to figure out how well we can do it. And it's been a great tool for improving these pipelines.
So I have a question about the shape. Are these like the optimal? Can you improve things about optimal shapeless as a decomposition? Is that something that image people worked out like years ago?
I don't think they're necessarily optimal. People looked at other ways of decomposing images. So I don't think there's any proof that these are absolutely possessed. They're Gauss Hermite polynomials.
They look pretty spherical.
They're circular, and there's also a size, an intrinsic size. And so that intrinsic size is another parameter that you fit for. Okay, so a lot of good signs have come out of weak lensing. Here's just an example of a simulated shear map. So if you have this map of weak lensing shear that you've extracted from your images, and you have the redshifts of all the galaxies in your survey, then that map and statistics tell you about many things. So first of all, you automatically map out the large-scale matter distribution. If you know where the shear is everywhere, you're essentially mapping out where the matter is, and including dark and baryonic matter. You can also learn about the evolution of this matter distribution, because you have many different redshift slices you can look at, and so you can look at what is the large-scale matter distribution in each of those slices, and so how does that distribution evolve over time? And so through that, you can learn about other cosmological parameters, including ones that characterize dark energy and dark matter. You can look into the non-Gaussianity of the shear field, et cetera. So dark matter mapping has been done. It was done first with the COSMOS survey, so it's only 2 square degrees. The imaging was done with Hubble, with the ACS IGAN, and all the redshifts were done from the ground. And it's not a super beautiful map, but it is a proof of concept that we actually can map out matter in the universe. And we can also, from that map, constrain parameters pertaining to the dark matter distribution in the universe. So here, confidence contours in 1, 2, 3 sigma in the omega matter sigma 8 plane. And the shading there is the reduced chi squared. And you see that the constraints aren't super tight, but they're there. And this is only a 2-degree-square survey. Future surveys that we're looking into doing with weak lensing will cover potentially half the sky.
Why is it cut out? Where there's dark on one side and light at the bottom, right? Is it just supposed to be pretty, or is it?
No, it's not. There must be some reason why they couldn't they can.
Because it's.
That's so unrealistic.
Yeah, it just doesn't work at all for some reason.
It's just sort of a funny cut. Steps.
Yeah.
I think maybe the scale was off or something. The color scale.
Color scale.
Yeah, I mean, if the chi squared is actually, I'm a couple of, so the minimum the chi squared is the best fit is true or not? That doesn't look like the minimum of the chi squared.
No, it does.
The
dark side.
Everything down there is very dark.
Yeah.
So maybe the color is not.
Yeah, everything down there is very dark, so I guess if you could choose one point, it would be just to this side of where it suddenly fails. Surprisingly, no one's asked for that question. But I can look back at the paper and yeah. So there are two papers, Massey et al. There's the science cover story, and then there's also the paper that has these plots that explains what they do. Also, I don't know if you can see in this room, but there are dotted contours there. That's from if you just take all of the shear information, you just condense it down into just one big slice, and then these solid lines occur if you do actually 3D tomography. So you can also get constraints in dark energy. This is actual data, I believe. So these are constraints in the omega dark energy and then the equation of state plane. So the green is what happens if you just use a CMB. We just use WMAP. And then if you add in supernovae that they had as of 2006, you get the red contours. And then if you add lensing to all that, then you get the blue contours. And again, it doesn't look very, good. For lensing, but actually, if we have these really wide field surveys that we're going to have in the next several years, the efficacy of weak lensing to constrain dark energy improves dramatically. So then the Dark Energy Task Force has even gone so far as to say that weak lensing is potentially the most powerful probe of dark energy. But there are all those systematic effects that I mentioned before, and those have to be controlled for weak lensing to achieve its full potential. And so along with dark energy goes modified gravity. And so if you can constrain dark energy, you can constrain modified gravity. And you can test GR. So of course, there's a good motivation for modifying GR on large scales, so you can match the accelerated expansion of the universe that we think we see, which contradicts GR, matter-dominated universe. And you see, this is one of the first plots like this done with the supernova surveys in the late 90s. In the omega matter, omega lambda plane, we see the confidence contours, and we see that a flat, dark energy-less universe definitely lies far outside those contours. But if we modify gravity on very large scales, we want to keep gravity the same within the solar system. So there are many theoretical mechanisms that people have come up with in order to do this, to modify gravity on large scales to keep it the same in the solar system. And all of those modified gravity theories will impact weak lensing observables. And weak lensing happens to be right in the sweet spot of modification, where the modifications are largest and where you'll see the biggest effects. So lensing in GR, you have some matter density, and then the gravitational potential is some function of that. And then the amount of light bending you see is some function of the gravitational potential. So I just left F and G, these two functions, just schematically like that. And then if you have some modified gravity theory, both of those functions can change. So this is why weak lensing is an ideal probe of modifications to GR, because it probes both how matter produces potentials and then how photons move within those potentials. And there are a lot of modified gravity theories. So there's a very large theory space. So it's difficult to go through and test each one by one. We would like to have model-independent tests of generic deviations from GR, And so that trying to do that is one of the things that I'm working on right now. So on small scales, we've been able to do this with the Fram Trice-Post Newtonian formalism, or PPN formalism, where we look at the weak field regime of gravity theories. If you look at any gravity theory that where the you have the weak equivalence principle and symmetric theory, you can write out the to second order in the gravitational potential, U being the scalar potential. You can write out the metric like so. There are some other terms that I'm neglecting. But there are these post-Newtonian parameters. There's beta, and then there's gamma and epsilon. Those parameters are equal to 1 in GR, but then they can deviate from 1 in modified gravity theories. So this is a way of parameterizing the ways in which a gravity theory can deviate from GR, and then you look at these parameters, where then you can constrain those with data. And then if someone comes along with a new modified gravity theory that they want to constrain, they can just look to your constraints on beta and gamma. They can work out the weak field behavior of their theory, and then determine what parts of the theory space are rolled out. So you can do a similar expansion on cosmological scales, but now instead of expanding around Minkowski space, you have to expand around FRW space. It's a little more complicated than that. Well, first off, the PPN parameters that you have, just for the solar system test I mentioned. This gamma parameter, I'm going to discuss gamma and beta mostly. This gamma parameter tells you how strong gravity is. The value is 1 in GR. And then beta tells you how much nonlinearity there is in gravity, and it's also 1 in GR. So I'm going to discuss mostly constraining those on large scales. But then, of course, there are all these other effects that you can get in modified gravity theories, and they all have parameters that denote how large of an effect you have. So in the solar system, there are many different tests you can use to constrain gamma and beta. From light deflection to the sun, you can constrain gamma minus 1 to be very small. And then the perihelion precession of Mercury constrains this combination of gamma and beta. So these combinations I'm showing here are the deviations from the GR values. You can see that they're both constrained very small in the solar system. But there is nothing in the PPN formalism that tells you that these parameters have to be constants and that they have to be the same on all length scales and at all times. So that's the question, are these parameters the same on all scales? If they're different on large cosmological scales than their GR values, then that would signal to us that there is modified gravity. So the PPF framework has been studied the last few years. It's a method for constraining gravity. So these parameters that I mentioned may change depending on the time or length scale, and there are three very important scales in cosmology. So there's the super horizon scales. So perturbations on those scales have to be such that you match the measured expansion history. And then there are really small scales, like for instance in the solar system, where we know we have to match GR. And then there's the intermediate linear and quasi-linear regime, which is important for weak lensing. And that's a regime where we would have our very important, easily detectable modifications of gravity in, say, DGP or FMR, these series that can reproduce the accelerated expansion rate. So what we've been working on is this intermediate range where you can write out the metric in the same way as you do in the PPN regime, but now there's an A squared in the front because we're expanding around FRW space. So again, beta, gamma, and epsilon are possibly time and scale dependent PPF parameters. Gamma is one that tells you how strong gravity is in the linear regime, and then beta and epsilon tell you how much nonlinear you have. And there's also gravity omega terms that I'm not writing down here. So my goal is to constrain these parameters with lensing data and then to test GR in the weakly nonlinear regime. So to look at what happens with beta and epsilon. Gamma has already been looked into, and I'm going to discuss it too. So the point is not necessarily that F of R gravity theory, you can write it down in this form. But you can still test GR by looking at a metric of this form. You can still see are beta, gamma, and epsilon still 1. And then if they're not 1, it doesn't necessarily tell you what the correct gravity theory is, but it does tell you there are modifications and that some modified gravity theory must be correct.
Excuse me, where are you getting A squared from? I mean, is it coming from FRW or you're also going to allow for modifications to that?
That's coming from FRW. Yeah.
Yeah, so why don't we believe that? And you're allowing yourself to have modifications in the R terms, but not in the A squared.
A modified theory could have different scale factors, basically, what you say.
Yeah, he has some
working
agreement for it.
So I'm assuming that the universe is homogeneous plus small perturbations. So there's some scale factor you can define that tells you the overall background expansion. And so that's going to be some function of time. And what you're saying is that that's going to depend on the modified gravity theory, right?
Okay. And that's true.
Yeah.
But you're also not allowing for any anisotropy, I guess, right?
Right. Yeah,
okay.
So.
And before you go ahead, why? Where do you see the binary pulsar data fitting into this? That provides enormously tight constraints on parameters in GR.
So that probes a different regime of length scale density scale.
Yeah,
so,
but it still constrains other theories quite tightly.
Yeah, it does. This is complementary to that. And what do you mean by isotropy?
Well, I just mean you've got dx squared is just, you could have different behavior in different directions when you get on cosmological scales, right? I mean, how do you know it really is a modulus line? So shouldn't we have PPN parameters for each of the directions of space in this formula, for example?
This is just for the scalar perturbations. So there is anisotropy in the sense of scalar perturbations, in the sense that the coefficient they're not the same.
Yeah, but why stick to scalar perturbations? Why not? I mean, in general, we could have anisotropy. It's another test, right?
It is.
Why should lensing out there be the same as lensing out there, for example? That's all I guess.
Right, yeah, and that's another test. So first off, this is just a gauge choice you're making. Beta, gamma, and epsilon can depend on location and time and spatial scale. And you're right that there are other kinds of perturbations that I'm not writing down, and that's because partially slide limitations. So there are vector perturbations that we put into, for instance.
I certainly agree.
I'm not including on the slide just because it's at the top.
All right. No, I certainly agree. You could constrain yourself to a model like this and ask what the data tells you about it. It's just that there are more general models. Anyway, go ahead.
So again, there are more general things you can write down, but this is a way in which you can. The point is that we're testing GR. We're not necessarily trying to deduce what exactly is the correct gravity theory. We're just testing whether or not GR is correct. So, so if we want to look into the nonlinear regime.
I think it's a little bit more than just testing GR, right? Because eventually you're assuming that GR is modified. But photons propagate along the null GR distance, right? So you're not allowing any particle physics effects to kick in as a photon propagates from over these large distances. So there are some models where, for example, photons will oscillate into something different and then back to the photon. And so in some sense, what you're testing is the integral effect, and it could very well be that there is just an extra particle physics. But the GR is perfectly okay.
So as long as we have a metric theory, we can write our metric.
But the question is what is observable? She's observing the.
But
if you don't have a metric, you have other components.
Oh, if you don't have a metric.
No, I'm saying you have a metric theory, and actually much more conservative. I'm saying suppose you just have the GR works beautifully, but there is just additional terms in the standard model. And so the photons that you observe that propagate along some algebraics interact in some weird way. And that interaction you mimic terms like this. I wasn't following closely, but I know that people come up with models like
Okay, so if it turns out that these parameters are different from the GR values, you're correct. It doesn't necessarily mean the GR is not valid. There could be other interesting new physics that we have not explored. And so you're right, that you could also even probe particle physics. And then you could also, there's a possibility that there's modified gravity and there's some particle physics interaction, like you're saying, that conspire with each other to cancel out some of the GR. Well, we hope that that's not what we're...
What's the logic of introducing, say, the U squared term both in time sign? Because you could always do a field redefinition on U, just get rid of one of those.
Right, so it turns out that beta and epsilon are functions of each other. And yeah, you can do a field redefinition. This is just a standard PPN formula, so this is just the way everyone writes out the word. But you are correct, you can just do a field redefinition.
But U is the is a Newtonian potential, so it's not a free function.
Right. So yeah, it's defined in terms of the density and velocity fields of the matter.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, so U is defined to be what it would be to satisfy the Newtonian potential.
Exactly.
It obeys Newton's equation. Right. That's its definition.
But there's a post-Newtonian contribution to it, too. It's not just the general, like, integral over density. So I'm going to say if you can redefine a new potential, that would make it so that the metric looks pretty much any way you want. So almost all the time when people talk about post-Newtonian or the parameterized post-Newtonian formalisms, they look at the point mass case. So for instance, in the solar system, we're just in the point mass case. We're just in a solar system with a very massive sun in the middle. So the post-Newtonian literature, almost all of it, U is a potential for point mass. But to look at weak lensing, we need U to now be general, arbitrary. I mean, it's not actually arbitrary, right? But for most of the calculation, we need to leave it arbitrary. And then also, if I want to get beyond that gamma parameter and constrain beta and epsilon, I need anomaly you're studying. So that's what I've done. But first off, why would you want to measure beta and epsilon? Isn't looking at gamma enough? So we got this beta and epsilon terms. So it turns out that some well-motivated modified gravity theories, I'm not saying all of them, but some of them that have been looked into with n-body simulations, actually deviate from GR significantly in this weakly nonlinear regime that's being probed by beta and epsilon, leading to very significant changes. Here's an example. Here's a plot from a recent paper where there are n-body simulations done in DGP. And here's the deviation of the matter power spectrum from that of lambda CDM that would give the same expansion history. And you see that there's a big peak there. And about the scale of importance to us. So there is a motivation for looking at beta and epsilon actually going beyond gamma. So that requires a... Yes? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not actually.
With the Joe Sinclair. Right. Okay.
No,
so draw cite Wyman and Corey Wyman. I remember what order it's in.
Cool it out.
That's cold.
So there is one issue though here, and there are two different types of nonlinearity that people talk about, and this type of nonlinearity is a bit different from the one that you see in simulations, because there's a nonlinear density fluctuation, there's nonlinear potential fluctuations. And if you look at U squared, it's actually very small in this regime. So it's always 10 to the minus 5 or smaller. But that doesn't mean these are linear. These are non-linear density fluctuations. So it's not obvious to me that terms of that sort would give rise to effects of this sort, unless those beta and epsilon are very, very funny.
They get to be very, very large. Like actually, much larger than not. I'm not talking order one deviation type order. Yeah, 10^5, and very, very large deviations in beta and epsilon.
But my point is that you would really want terms that go as density as squared as opposed to potential as squared, because that's the thing that's really
other than the normal gamma is the function of density, gamma.
So yeah, gamma can also be a function density. So it's there's a combination of beta, epsilon, and gamma squared that you constrain basically any of these observations.
So if you can't ignore the u squared, do you have to worry about u cubed and so on?
It depends on what observables you're looking at, but yeah, sometimes you have to go up in
here. Is there, at that point, is it useful to organize things this way? Or could you just have the u plus delta u or something?
Yeah, that's right. So gamma should be able to capture all of them. Shouldn't they? Like epsilon and... I mean, all you have is that because you have gamma u, people say gamma u part is just some delta. By redefining gamma.
Yeah.
Well, the reason gamma doesn't capture it is u is the Newtonian potential that you get from the standard GR. So
every time I'm making gamma a function of the Newtonian potential, right?
Because I mean, it's time and the space dependent. I could just put in an arbitrary function in gamma. It doesn't have to be, it could be 1 plus whatever you have in. Same. Since it's an arbitrary function, I could put in another arbitrary function.
So you need two arbitrary functions, one for psi and one for the two scalar models.
And for the other one, I have.
So beta is for a second.
U itself is not.
I think maybe we should do
it. So many different ways you can write these equations. I apologize that I'm only presenting the one way, which I'm doing. So I'll sketch out what I did. Starting from that metric that I showed, I solved for the light ray trajectory to second order in U using that metric. So there's some source and then there's an observer, and the dotted line shows the unperturbed ray trajectory, and the perturbed one is the curved line where there is this trajectory x and then the tangent vector to the rays is k. So you have the null genius equation, which I'm sure in this crowd you're all familiar with. And so you solve for k and then you integrate that to get the light ray trajectory. So once you have the light ray trajectory x, the deflection angle is a component of the trajectory shift that's in the plane of the sky. Instead, again, I'm assuming the flat sky approximation so that you have this unperturbed direction and then you have the sky where there are then two components in the sky. And then once you have the deflection angle alpha, taking the derivative of that with respect to the theta to position on the sky gives you this distortion tensor, which is that A tensor, as I mentioned before, minus the identity matrix. And so it has, it encapsulates kappa, the convergence, and the shear gamma. And if, for instance, you're interested in the convergence kappa, that would be one half matrix. And then the shear, you can see how you can extract that out similarly. And so in doing this calculation, there are many different nonlinear effects. So there's a Born approximation where people typically, when they figure out perturbed light ray trajectories, they do all these integrals you have to do along the unperturbed path. But if you're working the second order, you can no longer do that. You have to use the perturbed ray path. So lens-lens coupling, you can no longer divide the lensing potential into a series of lens planes, look at what happens from each of them alone, and then just add it up. You now have to look at how previous lens planes impact what happens at later lens planes. And there's a whole bunch of these nonlinear effects that happen when you do lensing calculations, and there's a recent paper by Krauss and Harada that covers them. So the convergence, just to write down some of it quickly, schematically. So this is convergence. This is related to the magnification.
Before you go on, yeah. The nonlinear things, those arise in general identity? And they're important for your observations, or is someone generating an actual market in new physics?
So this happens in general activity too. So these effects are important in general. So yeah, Krauss and Harada, I think, was only looking at general activity. And all the other papers that you'll see on these There have been many papers on these different nonlinear effects and trying to see how large they would be for future surveys, and those papers are actually all done within the context of GR.
But the effect is tiny, it depends on the amount of spots.
Well, so you can have, it depends on what observables you look at. For example, talk about the bispectrum where there are large effects. So the convergence as a function of the co-moving distance between source and observer, there's this distance weighting factor you have in the front. This is a standard answer that you get. There's a distance weighting factor, and then it's basically an integral over the density. So the amount of magnification that you get depends on the integrated column density. There's a factor of 1/2 in front, just from Newtonian physics, and then there's a gamma in there, which is 1 in GR. I'm leaving it arbitrary. And so this, in Fourier space, feels like k-squared u. And then there are nonlinear terms. This is the most interesting one, depends on beta and epsilon. And that term just depends, just scales like k-squared u squared. And then there are other second-order terms that are beta-independent. You can see here that if we want to constrain gamma, we can look at the linear piece of this answer and look at the power spectrum. And then if we want to constrain beta and epsilon, then we can use this nonlinear piece. This nonlinear piece, when you look at the bispectrum of kappa, this piece will multiply with this piece, and then you'll get a bispectrum that depends on beta and epsilon.
So just then these gamma, betas, and epsilons here, they could depend on W or W prime, I guess. Is that possible? Is that within the formalism or not?
So you can depend on the...
On the distance. I thought they could vary all over. So can they not? Can they depend on the distance or not in this context?
So you're right that I am tacitly assuming that they don't depend on the distance along the line of sight. So what I'm trying to do with this is probe just the scales that you probe with weak lensing. And I'm assuming that gamma, beta, and epsilon are constant on those scales. And then the question is, are the parameters you get on those scales equal to the ones you get in solar system scales? So that's what I meant by scale dependence. So you're right with it. I'm assuming
you're right. So these are constants.
These are constants, yeah. Okay, so if you want to constrain gamma, I'm just rewriting out the metric here because people use a lot of different terminologies for how these two Newtonian-ish potentials are related. So in this talk, I'm saying gamma is phi over psi, but other people do other things. And so like I said, gamma's already been constrained with data by other people. So Scott Daniel, Robert Caldwell, and others have looked into gamma. They assumed it's scale independent, but it's time dependent. And the same way as a cost module constant would be. So what they did is they defined this new bar pi parameter and said, let's make it zero in the early universe and let's have it turn on at about the same time as we would see a cost module constant turning on. And so then we have this redshift dependence where that bar pi naught now is a constant that they constrain. And so here are the constraints, bar pi naught and omega matter. Blue is for WMAP5, red is if you add in current weak lensing and supernova constraints. And then there are forecasts, which I think are interesting. Yellow here is what you get from Planck, and you see there's a huge degeneracy, as you might expect, if you're trying to look at this parameter that turns on now, if you're trying to look at it with a CMB. And then if you add in Euclid, which is the next generation weak lensing survey, you see that the constraints on bar pi naught get much, much better. Another constraints on gamma came from a recent paper from Rachel Bean, where she assumed that it was constant in redshift bins, and she actually called it eta and not gamma. And I'm sorry, I tried to get these plots, try to make them easier to see, but it's really hard to do. So on the left, we have the likelihood as a function of this 1 over eta. And you see where it peaks, and you see that the GR, the line you have for GR, where this eta is 1, is actually significantly off the peak. And that's because if she looks at the weak lensing, the kappa-kappa power spectrum, and you plot the CLs divided by what you have in GR as a function of L, you see that as you go to higher redshifts, so this is the lowest redshift bin, red is z of 1 to 1.4, and then the blue is the high redshift bin from 1.4 to 3. You see that the shear, the CLs, it's not shear actually, the CLs of kappa actually deviate significantly from GR as you go to higher redshifts. And so, is there too much shear at high redshift? And there are actually a lot of issues with this paper that I don't have time to discuss now, but if anyone wants to talk about it later, let me know.
But can you summarize it, please? Do people in the community believe it?
No, so people... she used the Cosmos... So I'm actually, I'm more of an observer, and I work in the Cosmos group, the group that made the data set that she's using. And the redshift information in this high redshift bin is actually extremely unreliable. And also, and she completely ignored some of the errors that you get on the redshifts. And so the confidence levels that she gets here are overinflated. Another problem is that if you look at the L's here, that's from L of 60 and below, this is actually, the Cosmos survey is 0.2 square degrees. So she's actually plotting here CLs for scales that are much larger than she should be able to probe with this survey size. So it's a two main problems.
So I think one thing else is, you should maybe compare this result to the previous one from Calvo, because it's not just gamma, it's the other equations that you assume.
Oh yes, so I'm not just saying, you know, so this might disagree with that. They assume different things, right? There's a redshift dependence here that they're assuming that Rachel's not assuming. She's just looking at each redshift bin alone and assuming. So you can't just blindly compare the two plots. So that is a very good point. So sorry to make that clear. So if you want to constrain beta and epsilon, you can look at the bispectrum, like I said. And you can recast this deviation as an effective FNL. So here I've written delta epsilon and delta beta as the deviations from the GR values. And I'm setting gamma equals 1. And this is highly oversimplified, and I apologize, it's for the purpose of the talk. And delta FNL is the change in the local type FNL that you would get from looking at the bispectrum of wavelengthing, FNL being that non-Gaussian parameter that everyone talks about. And also, epsilon is generally a function of beta. For instance, if you want to look at scalar tensor theories, there's a nice paper on that. And they're generically functions of each other. And so there's this one-on-one correspondence between the non-Gaussianity you see in the bispectrum and the values for these PPF parameters, which makes sense because of the PPF parameters that tell you how much nonlinearity you have in gravity.
So just delta epsilon and delta beta are deviations away from one.
From one,
of
yeah.
Those two parameters.
Right, yep. And my group member, Joel Berger, recently wrote a nice paper on discussing wavelengthing bispectral measurements and how you can get FNL through the wavelengthing bispectral. Okay, so I'm going to take the last few minutes and just talk about the future of wavelengthing observations.
Before you do,
yeah.
In the near future, what spaces do we have database?
It's very, very poor. So wavelengthing, it hasn't really told us that much because so we're going to talk a bit about what we want to have a good wavelengthing survey, and we don't have this at all right now. And one of the biggest problems is that we don't have surveys with good statistics. So it's this last point. So we really cannot constrain this at all right now, but then the future surveys will get a whole lot better, and I'm working on forecasts for how well we will be able to constrain those things, but I don't have them quite yet. So to get good wavelengthing measurements and to get good constraints on these parameters, we first need accurate galaxy shape measurements. So like I discussed, all systematics want them to be as low as possible. We need accurate redshifts, and then also good statistics are very, very important. And if you're looking at, say, the Dark Energy Task Force figure of merit, a wider survey for a given amount of time you have to do your survey, wider is better than deeper. And so this two square degrees we have from Cosmos survey is wholly insufficient. And so people are looking into doing potentially half sky surveys. And the constraints you can get with a half sky survey are orders of magnitude better than what you can get with two square degrees. So future possibilities for doing this. So there's the Joint Dark Energy Mission. On the left there is SNAP, which I worked on for a long time before it effectively dissolved because there are political issues with JDEM that some of you might be aware of. There's also ESA's version called Euclid. This is the merging of DUNE, which was to be an all-sky imaging survey in space, which would be a spectroscopic survey. And then also what I'm going to talk about right now is the High Altitude Lensing Observatory HALO, which is a balloon-borne optical imaging survey that we're working on right now at JPL. So here's the HALO team. The PI is Jason Rhodes. A lot of people from JPL working on this, but we also have a lot of international partners. Here's just a snapshot of weak lensing, past, future, and then hopefully very near term. So here's the end year, and then the statistical potential. So it depends on the area and the redshift of your survey. So down there at the bottom left is the Cosmos survey. That's at 2 square degrees with Hubble. At the top right, there's JDEM and Euclid, which are 20, 25, maybe even later. And HALO, this balloon-based survey, something you can do in the very near term, but then it's also something that will definitely fill that gap, the 20-year gap in between these surveys, for a very minimal cost. So to use a balloon, we're very well positioned at NASA. There's an ultra-long duration balloon program where they've been flying 7 million cubic foot balloons, and then they're working on ones that are even 2 or 3 times that size. And here's an idea of how big that 7 million cubic foot balloon would be. And this is what it looks like on the ground, and this is what it looks like once it reaches 30, 35 kilometers.
Is that the Washington Monument?
Yeah, that's the Washington Monument. And a 14 million cubic foot balloon can have a 2,000 pound payload. So you have to put a gigantic payload on these new balloons. And that's one of the few things that's enabling doing weak lensing from a balloon. Because to do weak lensing, you want a very large area survey. So you need a very large focal plane, which weighs a whole lot. And 20-day circumnavigations from Australia have been baseline for science within a few years. So that's the plan that we're going with. So here's some information on HALO. A 1.2 meter mirror, the same CCs as will be used for Hyper-Zabrankian. A single wide optical filter is based on the Euclid design. The redshifts will be from the ground. We're trying to keep it within that weight limit of 1,000 kilograms. And then it turns out that this only gives you about 2 terabytes of data. And you have to pick it up afterwards. So the balloon flies around the world, and then it comes down, and then you actually have to try to find your data later and hope that it didn't go somewhere really, really bad. Usually people find their data, and we will find our data. It will happen. And so I don't worry about showing you guys this diagram, because I know you're not going to ask me about it. So some key parameters. With one flight with this setup, we could get 200 square degrees, 100 times larger than the Cosmos survey in just 20 days. And there's a plus there because these balloons, once they come down, usually you can fly them over and over again. And so we could get much more than 200 square degrees if we had the number of flights. The PSS facility, this is another key point that only recently became good enough to enable weak lensing surveys from a balloon. Usually, they're not so stable, but there are the recent new technologies that have made so that now we can get the pointing to 0.1 arcseconds RMS.
So what was the new technology? Did they just go
higher?
No. Can they just
stabilize them? So there's a two-stage... there are two stages to the pointing stability. So they're getting improvements in the technology, the gondola So our gondola design is based on the BLASC survey, but it's enhanced with better controls and everything. And that can get you to 1 arc second, which is still definitely not good enough. There's a fast steering mirror system, and that's what enables you to get to 0.1 arc second. And that's something that's actually right now being developed at JPL. And so it's like, the gondola moves to get you to 1 arc second, but then the mirrors themselves have a control system, and they move themselves. And so there are these extra chips on the border of the focal plane that try to keep the guide stars. It's kind of like adaptive optics. They try to keep these guide stars stationary. And so that's how we can get to the point.
And so whenever it crashes, I think it is because it runs out of what's the 20-day limit?
No, I don't know. I don't even know how you get it down either. Probably won't shoot it because you won't fly. So I don't know.
I was just wondering. It seems like it just like crash landed. It wouldn't be.
Wait, you want it to keep at the same altitude, right? You don't want it slowly drifting lower and lower altitudes.
I see, so 20 days to stay outstream and it starts going.
That's when it comes back around to the same spot.
Oh, I see.
So that's how long it takes to circumnavigate the globe.
Oh.
So we need a very long exposure time for weak lensing, so we get good number density of galaxies in the field. Running out of time. This would give us 15-20 galaxies per square minute. If this overlaps with the survey, the dark energy survey area, that's a ground-based survey, then this will provide a space quality calibration sample.
How deep in redshift can you go with good accuracy? What's the farthest you can see?
So typically, I think a median redshift of 0.5.
And Jaden?
Jaden?
Yeah.
There's no actual
design. I'm coming from an extremely biased point of view. I'm thinking, why Jaden and not Lisa?
Jaden is... JDAM's not really a thing. I'm sure you know all the politics of JDAM. It's like they're right now assembling a new working group to determine the optimal survey strategy for JDAM. So we don't know what they've decided yet. I mean, they're assembling a new group to decide that. Answer just those questions.
Does that mean that they can quote you saying that they don't know what to do and therefore Lisa should go?
A lot of this is NASA and DOE politics, actually. It doesn't have anything to do with the science community. It has to do with politics of the J part of the Joint Earth Energy Mission as well.
Would it be good for me to remind you at this point that you're being videotaped?
Yeah.
But it's on Canadian television, so no one.
If you talk to anyone who's been in these science working groups, they'll tell you the same thing. So right now they're getting together a new working group to try to determine what the optimal strategy is. And the point of this is just to show the potential launch site. So we're planning on launching from Australia. You could also do South America. You can't. So mid latitudes are better in terms of sky backgrounds. You can't go too close to the poles because we can only do observations at night. And then we can't fly over Russia, so we can't use the northern hemisphere.
Sorry, I'm confused. So there's a lot of balloons coming from Antarctica, and they say that's a really good thing to do, and you hear you're saying the complete opposite.
Well, it depends on what you need, and we need an optical survey, and it won't work from Antarctica, because to fly our balloon, we have to go there and fly it. It takes 20 days, it comes down. Now, we need to do it at night, just because of the nature of our observations, and you can't fly to the South Pole in Antarctic winter. So it's technically not feasible to get there to fly the balloon.
But that's the experiments, which
are
packaging
today.
Yeah.
I think
just
go in
the summer and wait.
Yeah, just wait.
Go in the summer and wait.
That's
what grad students are for.
Um, Okay, so.
Oh, I guess that was take two.
You didn't have the money, Craig.
Oh.
So there are lots of hurdles in doing this, and there are reasons why people haven't done a survey like this with a balloon before. There are technical hurdles, so the pointing stability is really it's driven by this new technology, this fast steering mirror I was mentioning. You need to get very thermally stable. Stability is the key, basically. You need a large focal plane to do a large survey area, and that requires a lot of power, a lot of batteries, and there's a mass limit that you have to stay within. And then there are programmatic hurdles. There are a lot of technical requirements. This would be one of the most technologically advanced balloons to ever fly. And so it would have a very high cost relative to typical balloon missions. So we have many external partners that are donating pieces to get the cost down to something that JPL would like. And
so what is the number? Sorry.
I can't give you actual like hard dollar amounts. It's sensitive, but it really is. It's competition sensitive, but they want it to be an order of magnitude $10 million for everyone. So much, much less money than Lisa or Jana.
Are you willing to put corporate numbers on your own?
I'm sure, yeah. I don't know.
Not beer.
So here's a timeline. Proposals due in March. And then do their selections and everything with the balloon program runs really fast, way faster than with the space program, of course. We do a test flight at Fort Sumner, and then possibly by late 2014 or early 2015, we can do our science flight, and then within 20 days, we have our data. So the science reach of this would be pretty huge. It would be a very, very wide field optical survey, which you can use for many things. First off, you can learn about dark matter through beacon strong lensing. You can explore dark energy modified gravity, and here I'm showing some constraints on the dark energy equation state as a function of redshift. Purple here, the JDEM or Euclid, and then the red on the outside is the cosmos survey. And halo, with 200 square degrees is this seafoam color, and then with 1,000 square degrees is the blue. So you see we do far better than Cosmos. And then, of course, there's a lot of ancillary science because it's a huge project. And so here are my conclusions. We've gravitational lensing is an excellent cosmological tool. You can pro-modify gravity and dark energy with it. And this PPF formalism can give you some model-independent constraints where you can test GR, not necessarily figure out exactly what the particle physics nature of gravity or anything else really is, but it's a way that you can constrain the different ways in which gravity theory can generically deviate from GR behavior. And then future space flight data from HALO could make this possible. Thank you.
So we started a little late, so we're just ending right on time, so we have time for questions. Anyone has any questions during?
We'll be questioned out by now.
So a space quality means that you cannot do better by going to space?
In terms of the point spread function, so that smearing that you get from the atmosphere, you don't get, at the halo altitude, you'd be above 99% of the atmosphere. So you get negligible atmospheric seeing. But one of the problems that you have at balloon altitudes is there's still a layer at 90 kilometers that emits, there's a lot of OH and oxygen lines. And so there's some extra emission that you get from a balloon that you would not get from going to space. But by space quality, I mean in terms of measuring shapes, you do as well as from space. But maybe in terms of seeing as many galaxies, you might not see as many from a balloon as you would from space because of that gravity lower.
Any other questions?
No. So the PPF format that you're using is different from the one that wants the radio. They don't have this US.
So they just didn't get along. There you have only one function, G, which here brings you between y and the side.
It's gamma, yeah. But, so but that is other ones.
Yeah, but these other ones are the second one.
Yeah, so
the most important one is the ratio.
Yes, zeta lowercase g, which was the ratio of phi plus psi or phi minus over their sum, and so that's related to gamma, but I don't think that they looked at nonlinear parameters.
So Ali is going to be here the rest of the afternoon. So you want them to ask for more questions? Ask for more details about the same.